Hello and welcome everyone around the world for another exclusive presentation right here on Your Contact for the very best in UFO Paranormal Talk Radio on the World Wide Web. You're locked into KGRARadio.com. It is time, as we do every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, to bring you Grant Cameron and the Cameron Files. And now, your host, Grant Cameron.
Good evening. It is December the 18th, 2018, 1 week till Christmas. This is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to The Cameron Files. If you go to the internet and look up the movie The Conjuring, you will see the box office figures showing the first and second movie made $675 million. Tonight, I have Andrea Parent, who wrote the trilogy of books that led to the movies. Her books were called House of Darkness, House of Light. Andrea has just released a new book called A Wonder to Behold. She is also working on three new movies and actually told me a month ago that they actually apparently have built the old house on a set. And these movies will tell the true story of the experience that she and her family had back in the 1970s. When I first heard Andrea lecture a number of years back, I immediately understood that she was in the know. In November, I met with her at the Starworks conference in Laughlin, Nevada, and she granted me an interview about one of my latest obsessions. That deals with apports and how they relate to UFOs and reality. Andrea was very good and did a powerful interview explaining her involvement and what they meant. Unfortunately, the audio did not work, and Andrea has offered to do it again. This time, you, the audience, will get to listen, and you're in for a treat, because this dear friend of mine has great insight. Listen carefully. Good evening, Andrea, and thank you for offering to enlighten me and others as I seek the answer to what I saw in 1975.
Oh, it's my pleasure to join you, my sweet friend. I have been a huge admirer of yours for years, you know, and I don't go all fangirl on you. You know, I try to maintain some personal dignity, but, you know, you are the template for ufology. You are the person with the integrity to emulate in this field, to lift this field up from pseudoscience into science. You know, there's no science that's accepted on this planet right now that didn't begin as pseudoscience, you know, whether or not it was labeled as such. Yeah. And the more that we delve deeply into this field, the more that we see the connector points, the more that we understand that everything is one thing, that everything is existence, that everything is energy, and therefore there are no veils to pull down or shun aside. All we need to do is look at our universe, our old reality with new eyes. And once we can accomplish that, then we begin to really have an integral, even visceral understanding of how all the pieces of this elaborate puzzle fit together. And that's why I'm here to talk with you tonight about how I believe my foray into the fourth dimension with ghosts and spirits is what opened me up to the universe so that I could begin having my experiences at the tender age of 13. And I'm 60 now. So much has happened over those decades that has been enlightening for me that it's my privilege and my pleasure to be able to go around the country and lecture about it and bring this story to other folks.
Wow. Well, thanks for your kind words. And I had my sort of enlightening experience after sort of, you know, chasing nuts and bolts and documents and people who probably aren't going to tell you what's going on. I had my experience in 2012. You had yours early on, and mine was, my first one was UFO related in 75. 2012 was more when I got into the consciousness thing. Yours started as sort of paranormal. So can you explain for the three people in the audience who don't understand what you experienced in 1970s and sort of a brief overview of how this whole lifetime of, I guess, seeking the answers, how it began for you?
Well, my mom and dad, my mother actually found this gorgeous original colonial farmhouse in Harrisville, Rhode Island, in June of 1970. And we had been living in Cumberland, Rhode Island, which is, it's really a suburb of Providence. And it was not crowded, but there was a lot of really negative activity that was happening in the neighborhood. And my mom just kept saying to my father, I just want to raise my girls in the country. I just want, you know, to, I need a farm. I need to get them out of here. And he went away on a business trip, and she opened up the newspaper, and this ad just leapt up off the page into her eyes. And at 9 o'clock at night, she called the realtor, which back in 1970, that was just downright rude to call anybody at that time of night. But the woman was very gracious and showed her the property the next day. And my mom emptied our family bank account of the roughly $500 that was in it to put earnest money down on that farm so that she could have the pleasure of watching my father's head blow off when he came home. And you know, and he wasn't as bombastic as we anticipated that he would be. I was 11 at the time. My youngest sister was 5, and we ended up moving there 6 months later. Mom and dad went out to the farm to look at it, and then brought all of us with them. And it was a wonder to behold. It was the most extraordinary piece of property that I have ever seen in my lifetime. 200 acres of pristine, some virgin forest. Beautiful, beautiful place. Now, we visited it 5 or 6 times and got to know the owner, the current owner at the time, Mr. Kenyon. And none of us recalled, as I began writing the books in 07, I started interviewing every member of my family. To see, you know, what they remembered, what their experiences were, to make sure that I was consistent, you know, that Nancy didn't remember it differently than Christine did, than Cindy did, you know, that type of thing. And I just wanted to get everybody's stories told from the 10 years that we spent at that farm. And I asked them, does anybody in the family remember having any kind of supernatural activity or seeing anything untoward or strange, weird, during our visits to the property? And nobody did. Mm-hmm. It was just a beautiful colonial farmhouse, huge, massive, and a big barn and 200 acres of land with a river running through the middle of it and a big pond and an old cellar hole. And it was just a child's, you know, it was like a labyrinth of wonder. It was just an amazing place. It wasn't until the day that we moved in. And that was January 11th of 1971. My parents closed on the house about a week before Christmas, and my mother said, we're not moving during Christmas. So we moved in the beginning of January, and Mr. Kenyon was just moving his things out of the house. He really didn't want to leave. Bless his heart. His son really forced his hand about that because he was elderly and it was a remote location, and he built a small house on his property in the village for his father. But my father invited Mr. Kenyon to continue to live with us, which he was very touched, but he declined the offer. But he came and visited us very frequently until his death about a year and a half later. Mm-hmm. The day we moved in, my father threw open. It's a swirling snow and ice event going on in Rhode Island. So typical. But if you're a good salt of the earth Yankee, if it's moving day, it's moving day. And it doesn't matter if it's a nor'easter, it's moving day.
Yeah.
And so dad threw open the back of the van. He handed me a big box marked kitchen and said, take this to your mother. I went. It was freezing cold. So I went to the closest door, which was the door to the parlor. And I took a hard right into the dining room. Mr. Kenyon was standing at the table and putting away the last of his objects from the corner hutch into boxes. And there was another man standing in the corner, and he had a quirky kind of grin on his face, and his eyebrow was a little arched up, and he had one leg propped up against the wall, and his arms were crossed, and he's just staring at Mr. Kenyon. Well, I was a well-raised child, and as I passed him, I greeted Mr. Kenyon, and then as I passed this gentleman, I said, good morning, sir, and he just ignored me like I was not there at all, He just looked right through me and kept looking at Mr. Kenyon. So I walked into the kitchen and I said, Mom, who's that man with Mr. Kenyon? And she said, oh, honey, there's nobody with Mr. Kenyon. The sun's on the way. He's not here yet. Well, it was mayhem. It was moving day. It was chaos and bedlam. And the other moving van showed up with the movers. And, you know, my father's giving them directions where to put the beds. And there's stuff coming flowing in to the house. And right after I brought my box into the kitchen, my sister Christine came right behind me. And the first thing she said was, Mom, who's that man with Mr. Kenyon? He's dressed funny. And my mother's like, there's nobody with Mr. Kenyon, honey. His son's going to be here shortly. And then my sister Cindy walks in and she's like, Mom, who's that man with Mr. Kenyon? And then Nancy walks in right behind her and said to Cindy, did you see that man with Mr. Kenyon? I did, but he just disappeared. Wow. And that was our entrance into the paranormal world. We had just moved into a portal cleverly disguised as a farmhouse. And we didn't realize that from moment to moment, we could be in the 1800s, we could be in the 1700s, we could be in the 1600s. This house was, property was deeded in 1680, and the house was finally completed in 1736 after it had been built onto over the decades. So, I mean, this is truly one of the original colonial homes in America, and eight generations of one extended family lived and died in that house, and about a dozen of them that we became very familiar with apparently never left.
Wow. Did Kenya never have any experiences, do you know?
Not that he would openly admit to. And you have to understand, and I'm sure that you do, because, you know, we're roughly in the same decade area, age-wise. Yeah. It was a taboo subject. It was not something, you know, darling Mr. Kenyon, the day that we were moving in and he was moving out, just as dusk arrived, he asked my father to go outside with him for a walk. And in such inclement weather, it seemed a little counterintuitive. Why can't you just talk in the warm house? But he took him outside. And they were standing overlooking the back of the property. And Mr. Kenyon leaned over to my father and put his hand on my father's forearm. And he said, Roger, for the sake of your family, leave the lights on at night.
Wow.
Well, that was about as much as he was going to say. And of course, my father interpreted his statement as, you know, big house, lots of kids, the bathrooms downstairs, all the bedrooms are upstairs. If you don't want your kids tumbling down the stairwells, yeah, then you should leave some lights on in the house. But it wasn't until later that we found out from people that lived in the area that there was never a time that Mr. and Mrs. Kenyon had the lights shut off in the house. If it was nighttime, every light in the house was on all night long. And we believe that's how they held the activity at bay.
Wow.
Now, he did come and visit one time about 3 or 4 weeks after we moved in. And his name was Earl. His wife had died about a decade before he put the house on the market. And he came to visit, and my mom put a piece of her famous homemade butter pound cake in front of him and a cup of coffee. And she said, Earl, I hear very strange noises in the parlor at all hours. And he just reached over and patted her hand and said, swallows in the chimney, my dear, swallows in the chimney. So that's how he reconciled his experiences there. And I don't know what he saw. He never divulged anything of any detail to my parents. He always tried to make light of it or would change the subject if my mom brought the subject up. But we all believed that he knew that the house was active. I don't think it was nearly as active for him as it was when five little girls moved in with all of our energy. And, you know, five prepubescent kids is like a bundle of, I mean, and tomboys at that. So it was, you know, I do believe that there was something about the energy that we brought into the house that activated it in a much more profound way. And there was one spirit in the house that really detested my mother. She seemed to perceive her as some kind of competition, and she had a thing for my father, and she coveted us, the five children. And when she would make her appearances, she would threaten my mother to leave, and even threatened her with death if she didn't. So it was something, you know, to take seriously. But for the most part, the incidents that occurred in the house were what I would describe as benign. There were some spirits. There were spirits in the house that were benevolent, including the man that we all saw the first day that we moved in. My sister April was the only one that didn't see him because she was in the kitchen with my mom. She was too young to be carrying boxes. But the rest of us had a close encounter with him immediately, within 5 minutes of moving in. And yet it was as though they laid in wait until we actually owned the house and were there in the house as the tenants, the to dwell among them, that they made their presence known to us. And then it did not subside for 10 years. And even after we left the house, it continued and does continue to this day with every living member of my family.
So the phenomena followed you. So it was location, but it was also tied into your family, correct? Because it followed you to Georgia, and you have experiences now in you're in Florida, right?
Yes. Yes. It never stops. Once that door is opened, there you can't close it again, and you can turn your back on it and pretend that it doesn't exist, but eventually something will reach through and tap you on the shoulder and make its presence known. And you don't know when or how that's going to happen, what the circumstances could be. But when it does, you have this feeling of almost being weightless, almost in a bubble of air, just floating. It's really the most incredible sensation. I wish it for everyone. I hope that as we evolve in terms of our own consciousness and expanding our own ability to see multidimensionally, extra-dimensionally, and interdimensionally, and that's happening at a remarkable rate. It's incredible. I take people out all over the country by hundreds and thousands and take them out and introduce them to the galactic family. I introduce them to the spirits who travel with me. Mm-hmm. I have my guides or what I perceive to be guardians who are around me all the time, very protective influences around me. And I so deeply appreciate them. And I don't know why I was chosen. I don't know why I was chosen to see what I saw when a flotilla of spacecraft floated over the farmhouse a year after we moved in. It changed everything for me. Grant, it was my personal paradigm shift. And that's what I wrote about in my new book, because I had an experience this past May that so significantly impacted me that I had to push screenplays aside with very important people waiting for them in Hollywood, and push them aside and write this new book because I was instructed to do so. It was almost what I had to give back for receiving the gift of healing that I did. I was very, very badly injured, and I had a visitation in my own home, in my own bedroom, that completely, utterly, and totally healed my body. And the next morning, when I woke up at the crack of noon, which it's not like me. That might be when I lay down to take a nap, but it's not when I get up out of bed. And I walked out into the kitchen. And my father was standing there, and he's like, "Oh my God, oh my God!" You know, because I'd been for 3 or 4 weeks crawling the walls, like I couldn't even stand up. I had a lower lumbar sprain that was so significant that I should have been hospitalized with it. And instead, I just crawled from my room to my office, what I call the man cave, and just kept working and working on the screenplays. And then this happened, and that was it. All bets were off for the whole rest of the year. And over the course of the last 5 months, I've written and am right on the verge of publishing this book about UFOs and extraterrestrials, what I refer to as the galactic family. And I truly do believe that it was like the ghosts and spirits at the farm were like my gateway drug. You know, it's what opened me up to being able to see everything, because I accepted them. When I saw that spirit that first day that we moved in at 12 years old, I was quite certain that he was as solid as you or I.
Wow.
Am right this moment. I mean, there was nothing about him that was translucent or smoky or weird. I thought his clothing was strange. I even asked my mom, does everybody out here dress like this? Because, you know, they were handmade clothes. And it was most likely the apparition that I saw, the manifestation that occurred, was most likely Johnny Arnold, who in the 1840s or 1830s, I believe, crawled up in the eaves of the house, and he was an alcoholic, and he drank a bottle of horse liniment trying to get a good buzz on, and it killed him.
Wow.
And it was listed as a suicide, but he told me it wasn't a suicide. It was an accident.
Wow. Can you describe your sighting? Because your sighting was not an ordinary sighting. You're at 13 years old. And maybe how you think it ties in to the... Because before then, it would have been just poltergeist, ghosts, that sort of thing. And then suddenly this UFO thing, which I think you and I both come to the conclusion it's all the same thing. It's all one thing.
Yes. Yes. And I do truly believe that there is some point of correlation and integration and a meshing of the different dimensions. I don't think of death as death. I think of death as the beginning of a new life, and that people go on in some way, shape, or form retaining many of their characteristics from this experience elsewhere, based on my own perceptions of them. And, you know, somebody that was not particularly lovely in this life is not particularly lovely on the other side either, but it works. You know, and the opposite as well. We had benevolent spirits in the house that were very kind and very loving. I don't know how I got in the front yard. Grant, I'll never be able to tell you how I got in the front yard with four little sisters and a mother and a father and, you know, activity all around all the time. Why I was standing on the front lawn of the farmhouse alone. It was, I don't know if I was 12 or 13, because it was in October and my birthday's October 10th, but I know it was in that time frame, and all of a sudden it was a beautiful day. It was gorgeous, bright, bright blue skies, very colorful leaves, what was left on the trees. It was like peak. It was beautiful. And then all of a sudden it seemed like a massive bag of cotton balls got, spilled across the sky. And I looked up and I saw colors that I had never seen before. Now, I know I was young and my depth perception was off, but it felt like they were right on top of me. Right. And then all of a sudden, the sun that was starting to bank behind me to the west, everything went dark. And I saw a shadow coming over me, and it came to a point. And I looked up, I just lifted my head up and just watched what moved over me. And what moved over me was so huge that I can't tell you if it was the size of, you know, Fenway Park or if it was the size of Manhattan. It was massive. And it looked like an upside down city. There were tubes, square tubes, round tubes, of all different heights and lights all inside. It was close enough that I could see specks in the light that maybe could have been beings. It was that low. Yeah. And on both sides of it, it had symmetrical vessels that didn't seem to have any lines at all to them. They seemed to be formed into a single shape, and they were all geometrical forms, all geometric, round, rectangle, quadrangle, square, and they were floating equidistant from each other on both sides of this massive mothership, and absolutely silent, not a sound. I don't remember hearing anything except just as I saw the shadow of it, before I actually saw the vessel, I heard like a thunk that happened in my ears. And then it felt like I had a bubble around my head. I could not hear anything at all. I couldn't even hear birds singing, nothing. Oh. And I watched it slowly pass over the farmhouse and marveled at how extraordinarily beautiful it was and the sense of peace that I had and attachment that I had was, I think, what blew my mind and certainly blew my third eye wide open. Now, I always describe that as my first conscious contact, but I do believe that I had numerous incidents of contact prior to that that I don't remember.
Which leads to the question, I believe in reincarnation. Do you believe this is a random event? Do you believe that you chose to be in this experience, and why you?
I don't know why me. I'd love to know that, but I'm grateful for it every day. And I consider the 10 years that I spent living at that farm, in spite of the trials and the hardships, to be the best decade of my life, because I learned everything that I needed to know to get through this thing called life. I knew from a very tender age that there is something beyond our mortal existence. And all these decades later, I can't tell you exactly what it is, but it is something. And to me, that's the miracle. That's what's so extraordinary, is that some way, shape, or form, we go on. So that was one of the penultimate questions that humanity struggles with in the wee hours of the night when we're afraid to die. Now, is there something after? And so the two most important questions in life, at least to the way I perceive things, are, you know, do we go on after we die? And are we alone in the universe? And for me, the answer is yes, we do go on. And no, we're not alone in the universe, not by a long shot. What happened to me when I saw that flotilla pass over that house stayed with me in a way that it never left. It was like a permanent film that was placed over my third eye. It became a part of my consciousness. It altered me in every conceivable way, and it opened me up to the universe in a way that few people ever get to experience in this life unless they're brave enough to delve very deeply within. And this was given to me as a gift. I don't know why me. But I am truly grateful, and I know I missed one of your questions. You asked three.
Well, it was the question about the soul contract. Do you think that you have some mission? Because I always look at the only thing you have to worry about is where did I come from? Where am I going after I die? And what am I supposed to be doing while I'm here? Everything else is sort of irrelevant as to. So do you think that you have some sort of mission here? Because you have talked, we've talked before about the fact that you have some guidance where they are sort of instructing you, like you told the story about the little balls that said, don't forget us, and where you're sort of getting instruction and guidance to do whatever it is you're supposed to do. So it was this idea of, do you think you've been chosen, or that you have some special mission that you've agreed to do something here, and that you have something to help the world, and do you respect that mission that you've been given?
I feel a reverence, that kind of respect, something divine about it. You know, I don't espouse any particular religion, but I do consider myself to be a deeply spiritual person. And yes, I feel that in the last 10 years, I wandered this planet for decades, Grant, looking around going, what is this? What is this? You know, I always felt like a misfit, like I just didn't belong here, like I got dropped off here by accident. This isn't my home. I've always felt like I was just visiting. Nothing ever felt permanent to me. The only place that ever felt permanent, that felt like home to me, was the farmhouse. That was it. And every other place that I've laid my feet has been, okay, this for now, you know, and then we'll just move on, because it's the only place, it's where I felt like I belonged, because I could be in multi dimensions simultaneously, and that's what's comfortable for me. I do not enjoy 3D density at all. I find it oppressive. I find this planet to be, absolutely beautiful, and yet I'm deeply distressed about what we're doing to it. I have my issues with humanity at large, like snap out of it, wake up, you morons. You know, I'm sorry, I don't mean to, I'm not trying to talk down or to belittle anybody, but it's like, come on, just, look at this. And so I feel like I don't understand the dynamics of it. I don't understand why my family ended up at that farmhouse. Because there was nothing, there were no familial connections, there was no ancestral connection between the people that built that place and us. But there was a sense of familiarity there that has been unequaled in my experience in life. But I do believe that we were destined to go there. I don't think that anything that happens by accident. And then 30 plus years after we left, I was supposed to tell the story. And coincidentally, and there is no such thing, about 6 weeks into the project, as I began this enormous, what turned out to be a 7-year project, writing the trilogy, House of Darkness, House of Light, I got a phone call from the owner of the farm saying to me, a producer called and needs to talk to you. And can I give him your number? And, she and I were friends at the time. And I said, well, sure, of course. It ended up being the executive producer of The Conjuring. Yeah. Now, The Conjuring was based on the case files of Ed and Lorraine Warren, who were paranormal investigators. And they only came to our house maybe 5 or 6 times over the course of 18 months or so. And we lived there for 10 years. So consequently, there were many, many things that occurred at the farm that they never even knew about. But because Warner Brothers and New Line Cinema had a lead on a series of stories by Ed and Lorraine Warren and a series of their investigations, their most famous ones, including the Amityville Horror and the Annabelle doll, they decided to start with our story first because on his deathbed, Ed Warren described our haunting and their experience at our farmhouse to be, in his own words, the most intense, most disturbing, most significant of all of the investigations that they ever conducted. And so that's why the first film, The Conjuring, was based on our story. And then they did the Enfield Poltergeist in England was the second one, and the Annabelle doll thrown in there somewhere. And I don't know, I've never seen a horror movie before in my life until The Conjuring came out, and I had no choice. I had to go see it. And it's like, okay, well, that's wrong. Oh yeah, okay, that didn't happen. This isn't anything like our story. And unfortunately, Hollyweird decided to go method formula. They had my books. James Wan read my books, freaked out when he read them, said, we can't tell this story this way because nobody will stay till the end of the movie to watch it. They'll run out screaming, and so they, even though the screenwriters attempted to integrate some of the truth into the film, the big boys up at Warner Brothers said, take that out, take that out, take that out. They sent that script back 7 times. And made them take out virtually everything that had to do with the truth of our story. And yet some elements did penetrate it in the strangest ways. There were what I refer to as the cosmic kisses, the things about the film that nobody could have known about that worked on that set or the stage design or anything, including a picture of a white cat, a folk art cat, that's propped up on the mantel board in Shanley Caswell's bedroom, who played me in the film. And I almost fell back in my chair when I saw that scene, and the camera pans around into my bedroom in this movie. And there's the exact duplicate of a picture on the mantel board in that room that's hanging in my office that was given to me for my 13th birthday by my mother's friend when we lived at the farm. And I've had it ever since. And no one that worked on that film knew that, So, I mean, there were things that were just weird. They chose the exact same wallpaper, the same wind chimes, weird stuff. So, you know, I just have to let it go because, Grant, I've got to tell you, my books would be languishing in obscurity if it had not been for The Conjuring.
Yeah, it helped move the ball down the field, correct? Even though it may not have been an accurate version. And you've gotten control of the story now, correct? Can you talk about your new movies and how you are going to really tell the story the way it happened?
Yes. Well, you know, I think that had the film been accurate, or at least more accurate, I wouldn't have felt compelled to write the screenplays. But I wanted to do justice to the story. And about 2.5 years ago, I got a call from a producer in California who expressed interest in it. And I went out and I met with him. And it turns out this guy's like salt of the earth and a real big deal out there. And he said, we want to tell your story the right way. And I said, nobody's telling this story unless I'm completely in charge of it. And I write the screenplay because there is no point in making another fictionalized version of events that is an inaccurate portrayal of my family. And he's like, yes, ma'am. You know, that was that. And so, yeah, I'm, you know, I'm kind of the person in charge of making this happen. And I've written the first screenplay. I'm more than half done with the second. And I'm going to combine the second and the third together because already we have 7 hours of film. So what we're going to do is use 3 casts of children and use some illusions by a master illusionist, Aidan Sinclair, because I want people to be able to actually see what we saw, not Hollywood's version of what a spirit looks like, but actually recreate what we saw. And he's fabulous at what he does. So, and is a good friend of mine. So we're bringing him into the project, and it's a huge project. It's absolutely overwhelming. Don't force me to think about it right now, Grant, because I'll go into meltdown. It's like I have never worked so hard in my life. But, you know, the first screenplay converted into, you know, actual official screenplay form where they break it down in how many minutes per scene to 7 hours. Wow. And so we're going to film the whole thing. It'll probably come out to 20 hours on film to cover the whole 3 books in the decade that we lived there. Right. And we're going to shoot the whole thing, start to finish, and then we're going to pull a feature film, 3 feature films out of it, you know, nice, tight, succinct. And then after the films are released, we're going to release the entire thing out on Netflix because it gets the most visibility. And I care that, you know, the most people get to see this whole story in its entirety and an accurate version of events.
In terms of it being a sort of a tough thing that you've got to go through, almost like the experience you had in the 70s, one of your favorite stories you tell is the chicken egg story. Can you tell that and how that applies to how we should maybe deal with life?
Yes. Well, you know, I have this thing that happens to me about between 3 and 3:30, very often 3:33 a.m., and I wake up abruptly.
Okay.
And it happened to me about a year and a half ago, maybe, but it was a little earlier than usual. It was strange, about maybe 2 o'clock in the morning, and I had just gone to bed. I had been working quite late that night, and so I was like, leave me alone. I'm not coming out. Leave me alone. I'm going back to sleep. And then I got kind of shoved around a little bit more again, and so I thought, okay. And I went outside. Thankfully, it was in the summer, and it was nice and warm, and I could be barefoot, and walked out into my very generous driveway and looked up at the universe and said, what is it? You know, which was a really bad attitude on my part, and I'm really sorry, because I immediately got a wonderful gift given to me, and it wasn't that I saw a flash of light or I saw a vessel. I didn't see anything except in my mind's eye, and it was an explosion, just a bright, bright white light, and then an image, a vision of standing in a chicken coop with my mother and my sisters when I was 12 years old. It was the first spring that we had lived at the farm, and we went there to buy some fresh eggs. It was just across the border in Connecticut. So we all piled in the car and went for a ride, and while my father was talking to the farmer, his wife brought us into the part where they let the baby chicks be born. So we were all excited, you know, and we walked in there, and a couple of the eggs were moving around. You know, you could see there was a tiny, tiny little beak just trying to push its way out. And I reached over to press my thumb into the egg to help the baby be born. And my mother quickly grabbed my hand and retracted it and said, "Oh, no, Ani, you can't help the baby be born, because if you do, it will die." And I went into meltdown, like I came within a hair's breadth of killing a baby chick because of sheer ignorance. And my mom was very kind to me about it and explained to everybody that the strength that baby has to use to get its peck its way out of its egg is equivalent to what it needs to survive on the outside of the egg for strength. It has to build its strength that way or it will die. And so all of a sudden, boom, comes this thing that I hadn't thought about since it happened, because I learned my lesson that day. And so consequently, I didn't have to keep it in the forefront of my consciousness. It got shuffled to the back of the computer and I just moved on with life. And it was suddenly back there. I mean, every frame, every moment, I just relived over a few moments, relived that event. And there had to be a reason for it. So I come back in the house, open up the computer into the man cave, and I wrote a treatise called The Chicken and the Egg. And I drew, I used it as a metaphor for our breaking through and expanding into our multidimensional universe out of our 3D relegated safe womb like egg, and that we have to peck our way out. Now they're coming from all around the universe. Our galactic family is here in droves, in numbers that most people would never be able to comprehend, couldn't wrap their minds around. I see them all the time. They make their presence known to me so regularly that it's nothing paranormal to me at all. It's a perfectly normal part of my life. I always get excited. I revert back to like 5-year-old status every time I see one, because I'm so thrilled to have the experience. But it's a perfectly normal part of my life. And what I do is I introduce people. I show them how to open themselves up. I show them how to look at the sky as if it was one solid object, not to focus with human eyes in one particular area, but to look at it as though you're fuzzed out in front of a computer screen, like you've just worked too many hours and all the words are just blending together and it's all just one gray thing. And I show them how to look at the sky that way. And then I sing. You know, I do a lot of what Steve Greer does. You know, it's a different approach. And I sing their favorite songs that they let me know that they particularly like based on their reactions to them. And, you know, I'm a stage trained singer and actor, and I did that for decades and decades of my life. And even though I don't have the soprano voice I once did, I can still belt out a good show tune. Right. And they love the songs stuff from the 30s and 40s. Pardon?
What songs do they like? Give me an idea which ones that you would use.
Well, they love The Impossible Dream from Man of La Mancha. That's one of their very favorites. Okay. I Love You for Sentimental Reasons. The Nearness of You. They love Cole Porter. They love Gershwin. They love, but they love some of the newer stuff too. From Tommy, The Who, the rock opera, See Me, Feel Me, Touch Me, Heal Me. They love that. They love, Stevie Winwood's Higher Love. They have very eclectic taste, just like me. And I can't tell if they just love what I love because I love it and they love me, and so they're going to love what I love, or if they're planting in my mind songs that I need to learn to, you know, make them happy. But these are all songs that I grew up listening to. My father was, you know, really into the singers and standards of the 30s and 40s. And we always had WLKW on our radio, and it was the oldies station, you know. And back in the 70s and the 60s, the oldies station was the 30s and the 40s. So yeah. That's what I grew up with. It's a wonderful experience to be able to go out there and to connect with them. And yes, I do perceive it as my mission now. I truly did wander around this planet feeling absolutely lost and out of my skin. I had an experience, speaking of reincarnation, see, you have to rein me in with the hook, but I do come full circle eventually. And I had an experience when I was 17 years old at the farm that I did not disclose to anybody in my family until after we left the farm, because I didn't want them to worry about the same thing that I was worried about. And that is, I had an experience with an apparition who manifested on the hearthstone in our parlor. And I was standing there and my whole right side of my body went like a slab of ice. And I could only turn my head, and I turned and I looked into the face of a woman who was a mirror image reflection of myself as an old woman. And she had, her hair was gray, thick like mine, all swept up in a loose bun. And she had blue sparkling eyes that were identical to mine. And when she smiled at me, I was like, oh my God, I've been here before. And even though every member of my family saw her, none of them saw her face because she was turned to face me. And when she evaporated into thin air, I went over to the dining room table and I joined my family and just focused on my food and didn't discuss any of it. I did not want them to feel like we were in a, you know, like Groundhog Day, you know, we were in a rerun through history as a family, and that somehow we were going to all end up back at that farm for as long as that farm exists. And yet there's a part of me that feels like I've never been here before. This is totally foreign territory. You know, I've only got my internal compass to get me around, and I don't really belong here. And somebody made a really big mistake. But now I understand that I'm here to share my truth, to speak my truth, and to share it, and to be not afraid, and to dispel fear in others. Because if there's one thing that I know, we are truly loved by the galactic family. They're not here because, you know, we're some sideshow in the back end of the universe. They're here because we matter to them, and we are all integrated. And most of the encounters that I have had have been with beings that are humanoid.
Okay. And sort of benevolent, do you think that there's a special time? Are they here at this time in this place? And are you here? Is this a special time in history where we're supposed to wake up?
Yes, this is it, my dear. This is the paradigm shift. As I describe it, the holy shift. I mean, everything, all the upheaval, all the discord, all the toxic waste that was, you know, settled at the bottom of the cauldron has been hit with flamethrowers and has bubbled to the surface. And what is toxic in our society, what is toxic in our world, what is toxic in our character, what is toxic is rising to the surface to be cleansed for all of us. And it's a very, you know, people are like, oh, woo-woo, enlightenment. There's nothing easy about enlightenment. Nothing. It is deeply disturbing. It is a very difficult process. And it's why most people live superfluously. They live superficially. They live right on the surface of everything. Because if they go too deep, it gets too dark. They get too scared. And it's too hard. I get it. I've been there and I live there. So, you know, seeing the universe with my eyes is not always the easiest thing, but it's also necessary because I'm also courageous enough to speak openly and honestly about it. And I'll tell you, my family knew everything about my ET connection and their own over all these years. And when I started writing the trilogy, I had several of my sisters say, don't talk about the ETs. Yeah. Don't talk about that because we want people to take you seriously. I'm like, I'm writing about dead people that are still kind of living and show up to live with us. And but you want me to not talk about the ETs because you think I won't be taken seriously when I'm discussing sentient, prescient beings who are here to help deliver us and help save us from ourselves simply by making their presence known around the planet. And that's not okay. Well, it's got to be okay. It's got to be okay. And, you know, they finally understood my point of view, you know, because everything is one thing. It all falls under the same umbrella. It's existence. Let's discuss existence and the importance of our existence and why each and every one of us is here at this pivotal, critical time in the course of human evolution. It's now, baby.
Is that what's in your book, The Wonder to Behold? Do you go through that in this latest book? I think it came out last month, did it?
No, it comes out in a couple of weeks. As soon as they finish formatting it, it's done.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I'm all done with it. So I just have to wait for the publisher to give me the release date. But it should be, you know, days to a week. They're formatting it for softbound, hardbound, and all the e-readers. So that takes a little while. But it's coming right along. And yes, I cover that and so much more.
Wow.
So much more. It's a true memoir. It is a revelation of every major experience that I have had, every close encounter that I have had in my life, and also family members that have had them, and the experiences that I've had through others with a particular being that goes to them and gives them messages for me, but she can't come to me because she claims that she is me in an alternate dimension.
Wow. I've never heard that one before. That's pretty bizarre. Are they having lots of experiences, the rest of your family?
Regularly. Always.
Wow.
Yeah, everybody does. And, you know, I'm so grateful that I've seen what I've seen and I know what I know because my baby sister April died in March of 2017. And I don't know, had I not experienced what I did as a child and since then, that I would have recognized it when she came to let us know that she was fine. And she has been to every one of us, has come to every one of us on numerous occasions. To the point that Chip Coffee, my dear friend, says, let her go. She's got other work to do in the universe, and she keeps coming to make sure you guys are okay. Just let her go.
Beautiful. Beautiful. The test has only got 2.5 more minutes here, so I need to go to a ports, because the way I see them, it's sort of like crop circles or like ground traces, like these little breadcrumbs that sort of just keep nudging you to say, you know, take a look. This is, you know, something's going on here. And you had some experiences with ports where things are moving around and stuff like that. Can you tell a couple of those little stories?
Yes, actually, we had an incident where my mom and dad at the farmhouse were having an argument about the spirits. And my father was denying their existence. And my mother wanted to, you know, end his. She was really aggravated and had every reason to be during that particular encounter. But they were in the midst of discussing the activity in the house. And all of a sudden, one of my mother's antique bottles came flying off the sideboard and went right through the middle of the kitchen, slammed into a 200-year-old glass window, and neither the bottle nor the window fractured. And it just fell to the floor, and my father walked up to it, and he picked it up, and he just looked at my mother, and he said something I can't repeat, but not on your air anyway. But, you know, he basically had to, that was his moment of acknowledging that there was something going on in the house. Right after April died, I was sitting right here on the porch that I'm standing on right now, and a hummingbird feather fell into the palm of my hand. I find things all the time. You know, people say where feathers are near, angels. What is it? When feathers appear, angels are near.
Near, yeah.
You know, if angels exist, they're probably an extraterrestrial race and completely and totally benevolent. My sister Cindy has seen one. I never have. No, my sister Nancy has seen one hovering over Cindy. I have not ever seen an angel. But I think they're interdimensional beings in the same way that so many of the other races are that visit the planet. But I just tell people all the time, the universe gives us little breadcrumbs just pick them up and marvel at them, exactly, because they too are a wonder to behold. It's just the universe, you know, if we'll just open ourselves to this incredible, incredible place, then what we will experience will seem like magic. But magic is just science we don't understand. It's messages that come from the great beyond. And all we need to do is pay attention. Beautiful. And it can literally change your life.
Beautiful. How do people contact you if they want to follow what you're doing and your movies and your books?
I have a new page on Facebook called A Wonder to Behold, where people, that's where I'm going to announce the release of and everything having to do with the new book. Of course, I have 6 pages on Facebook. I'm very easy to find. I have websites everywhere. I have YouTube channels everywhere. Just Google my name and boom, up they come and you can take your pick.
Beautiful. Thank you, Andrea. It's an honor to know you and to hear your stories. And when I get together with you, I'll tell you my feather story, which is very bizarre. So thank you very much.
Oh,
and
thank you.
We'll meet up down the road. And I really appreciate your being on. Thank you.
My pleasure, dear. Good night, honey.
Okay. Good night. And I'll send it back to Race.
You've been listening to The Cameron Files with Grant Cameron. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission from Grant Cameron himself or the KGRADB is strictly prohibited. The Cameron Files, in direct cooperation with the internet website beyondpresidentialufo.com.